SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Thursday, race fans. Sirius 162, XM 207, Sports Zone 999, if you're listening to Sirius XM online, and at our website, stevebick.com. You know, I'm laughing because there's a general rule in broadcasting. You can't do your show if your headset's not on. Yeah. There's no headset. There's no microphone. Exactly. I'm sitting here like ready to roll. And not so easy. And I said, I looked up. I said, it's 9 o'clock. What am I doing? Good morning. It's a little inclement up here, and keeping an eye downstate, and of course keeping an eye all the way down to Florida because of the. Because of the storm, and you know, it's going to work its way up the coast. New York, you know, Saturday, obviously, we got a stakes card, and we've got, you know, win in your ins dotting the country. I'm going to spread things out a little bit because with the intense action in California, in particular. This weekend, we have a lot to do tomorrow. So we're going to do Churchill today. All right, going to have KK and Caitlin in hour two. I sort of moved things around, and then I just got word that Jeff Franklin is forced to cancel. He's got a. A little illness to deal with, so best wishes to Crafty, get him squared away. But I'll certainly in hour three, after we talk to Dave Hill, I'll go through those two races. And I, as I mentioned yesterday, the win using Thorograph is. The 8th and the 9th from Santa Anita. And the convenient, based on what, you know, we heard from Peter Rotundo yesterday, in terms of the two-day wagers. So I'll go through it. And you know, it's funny, as I went through, I gave... You know, the Santa Anita sequence, you know, kind of a first look, first serious look, besides just, you know, names and post positions. But the nightcap, the City of Hope, was very good, really good. And of course, Johannes, the horse to beat, but. He's the horse to beat. It's clear, and I don't think we've got morning line yet. So, we'll probably end up looking at the last three races. But I best for Jeff. Hope he's okay. All right. So, Tom Law is going to join us early. We'll do a little bit of post. You know, I said to Tom, I kind of swapped him and Caitlin and KK for the Churchill action. I never saw Tom Law at Parks on Saturday. there was a big crowd. It's one of those funny things. Well, and they and what Tom does, you know, he basically runs the media portion of things for them the last several years, and they take like a, it's not even a room really, it's sort of like a pass through on the first floor or that half first floor, sort of a mezzanine, and they close it off with curtains and they make that a media area, which and it's well located actually. You can get right out to the winner's circle and the track apron. But I saw Dave Groening early in the day, and but then I never saw Tom. So anyway, we'll get his take on what went on, and Tony too. We got I barely saw Tony too. I mentioned that I was with him for, I don't know, 5 minutes, him and his son, and then he was on the other side of the room, and then a couple of times either I was with groups of people or he was. So we'll catch up with Tony as well, and Rich Eng at the end of the show, see what's up with Rich. Haven't talked to him in a couple of weeks. So and Dave Hill for week four, NFL week four. All right. See if things have firmed up a little bit more. And, you know, it's interesting. I forgot to talk about this as early as yesterday. Yesterday on, I think it was it must have been Tuesday. There was a piece, and I'm going to try to pull it up, that I sent it to Andy, and then I know Andy circulated it around, and I sent it to Dave Hill, and it was in the Atlantic on, I guess it must have hit Monday. I probably got to it Monday night, and it's about sports betting, and racing's not mentioned at all. Legalizing sports gambling was a huge mistake. The evidence is convincing. The betting industry is ruining lives. Charles Fain Lehman wrote this piece, and I'll put a link up. Let me see if it's a free piece that you don't need a subscription. It's unsettling. And I want Dave to comment on it too, because of course he has spent basically a year, this piece for Rolling Stone, he's basically spent a year covering, studying, attending, not just sports betting, but gaming conferences around the country. And I'm very curious. Lehman, who wrote this, he's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he's contributing editor of City Journal. And he cites some, and obviously, you know, sports betting is, you know, it's still in its infancy, I suppose. He cites three early studies, University of Oregon economists did one, a second from Brett Hollenbeck of UCLA, and Larson and Proserpio of USC did one, and a Northwestern University economic department working paper, two of them actually, talking about, I don't think it's not a stretch to say costs of sports betting, and the conclusions, seemingly, that weave all through the three pieces, the three different studies. Part one is that, first of all, sports betting hasn't necessarily impacted illegal sports betting, you know, meaning the bookmaker world, and that it is impacting those that can least afford to bet and to lose. You know, those you can't even identify their betting bankrolls as expendable income, you know, which is really, I think, kind of the way a lot of us as horse players identify, you know, our bankrolls. I mean, it's money that, you know, we use, you know, essentially as hobbyists and, you know, for our enjoyment with, you know, the expectation and hope that, that we can make a little something and, or at least, you know, stay even. And then, you know, some of you that are at a higher level, in terms of your commitment, and your investment of, bankroll against the game, you know, playing with rebates and, you know, trying to break even and then make something on, you know, on the rebate money. And of course, we've had the advantage as horse players of a mature marketplace. You read this piece, unsettling is the right word. Aside from the economic cost, and frankly, they conclude that the tax benefits have not been what was anticipated. In fact, they called the tax generation anemic. And then there's the most upsetting part of it, which is domestic violence. And the human cost. So I didn't see where there was a tremendous amount of this week. I didn't see that there was a tremendous amount of, you know, sometimes a piece like this, you know, you would think would catch, you know, particularly those of us that are involved in a gambling game. So I'll put out the link and I'll see if you, you know, I've never really done this. If, you know, sometimes you can give a gift, you know, you can give a gift link. I'll figure that out. All right. So I wanted to throw that out there because I'll certainly ask Dave about it. And I know, you know, Andy and I discussed it, and he sent it along to, I know he mentioned, he said that Dave O'Rourke and others. So, yeah, I'd be curious what people's reaction to it is. All right. Aside from that gloomy, yeah, sorry. I don't purposefully bring these things up, right? I'm not trying to start the morning on a downcast basis. I will mention a retirement that is rather notable. And, you know, Adair Manor had not been working. And it's actually something else Andy and I were talking about, because in the wake of the the Cotillion, and then sort of anticipating, you know, the distaff field. Well, Adair Manor officially retired yesterday, and, you know, she had not worked, and so obviously they were dealing with an issue. You know, she had a nice enough year, and she figured to be, you know, she figured to be major heading into it, into the distaff, but yeah, she won the Apple Blossom earlier this year, and most recently at Del Mar, you know, 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago now. And that's I think that's what, yeah, let me see. I don't think she had a single, well, she'd actually, she worked twice. She did work twice after the Clement Hirsch. So, and including a six furlong, 112. So, she did at least work twice, but not since. So she came out of that between the race and the works. She came out a miss, and she'll sell in November. Ends up 3-for-4 for the season. She got beaten the Beholder Mile to start the year, but that got her ready for the Apple Blossom, she won the Santa Margarita as well in May, and then the Clement Hirsch. So let's see, for the 10-for-18, she had a nice career, and another 5 placements. I'm just curious. She did not break her maiden until January of her 3-year-old year, actually. She had 2 starts at 2, and then broke her maiden in January of 22. Won the Las Virginis, second in the Santa Anita Oaks, then Black Eyed Susan, Cotillion. Not great. Got put away for the winter. Came back and had a very good 4-year-old year where she won Santa Maria, the Santa Margarita, and the Clement Hirsch, as well as the Zenyatta. Then did not have a great, did not run well in the distaff. Then came back and was on her way seemingly to another, you know. So anyway, you would think that she'll be a very attractive broodmare prospect, Adair Manor. Michael Lund Peterson, of course, and Uncle Mo Philly out of a giant gizmo mare. Yeah, I had forgotten that. Brooklyn's Way. She made $2,096,000. And what did she? Let me see something. Bernie Flynn had trained the for his big client, for Naveed Deshawan. Brooklyn's Way, Ontario bred. She was an OBS purchase, Julie Davies, who does a great job. Julie Davies had prepared Adair Manor. And $375,000. So she certainly paid for herself, as the saying goes, right? Adair Manor. So it opens up. I won't say it opens up the distaff only because, you know, they're going to have to deal. She was going to have to, Torpedo Anna, she was going to, you would think, was going to have to deal with a Dare Matter. Now everybody else that's left is going to have to deal with with Torpedo Anna as a result. So, all right. Those were the two opening salvos, as we say. Keeping an eye on for later, for the Pick Six carryover in New York, 44,000, and I'm waiting on some scratches. That there's that one maiden claimer that is just a mess. So we're gonna have to I'll make an adjustment when the time comes. All right, let's go get Tom Law and. Brian, let's get Tom in here, and we'll catch up with him. I don't think we've talked to Tom since the end of Saratoga, right? All right, we'll get that done. Then later, Tony Black, KK, and Caitlin Free. We never got to Caitlin on Friday because she had to go on TV, so I sent her an apology, and we will not. We will not miscue that again. And actually, you know what? I'll save the Churchill recap from yesterday for their visit. No reason to go over it until they come on. All right. So we'll do that. Other than that, it's just gearing up for the weekend. Tom Law joins us now. Tom, good morning.
Steve, good morning, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. I reached out to you because we were due for a This Is Horse Racing visit, and coincided perfectly with the weekend at Parks, and then I realized I never saw you on Saturday.
I know. I was in the media room, contracted by Parks every year to kind of come and help out, run the notes team there, and kind of man the press box / media room, and get the pile of credentials there, and yours sat on the little counter there behind me the whole day. I kept wondering, where is my friend? Is that coming? And then I said, well, you know, I knew it was his anniversary, and, you know, maybe he was living it up. And then I said, well, maybe he didn't come. And I thought, nah, he's got to be here somewhere. And then I saw some pictures. You were in the high rollers. So that's why you didn't see me. You know, you're big time in a game. But,
I did not big time anybody.
You didn't big time me, but you were big timing. Yeah.
I wasn't. Well, Will Schwartz, was in the second. He won the second, actually, and it looks like a horse that is actually going to be very nice, a filly that he and John Service offered up, and should continue to be worth watching as she stretches out. So we were with Will, and then Johnny and Gail, who we always spend Pennsylvania Derby Day with, and we always end up at Non Solo Pasta going to see one of Gail's clients, and we've been going there. This was apparently, because Johnny and Gail figured it out, this was our ninth straight year.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, that's a tradition. That's a tradition.
Oh, I love traditions. That's great.
How many years do you have to do something in a row for it to become a tradition?
Oh, I think at least, anything more than two, maybe. If you go, back-to-back years is not really tradition, per se, but,
no.
Three or four, I think you could
say. Yeah.
In a K, it's a tradition. Yeah. I'm with you on that. I need some good. Next time I go down there, I need some, I got to get with you and get some, we work. I'm on the notes team with a couple other guys. We just kind of like, we work most of the day. I'm not making it sound like we're slaving away or anything like that, but and then we end up just by default we're like, all right, let's just go over to the casino and get something to eat in one of the restaurants over there. But we're always kind of like talking like, we need to go off site, let's just go off campus. We joke about it, and we got to do it at least once. I felt like the first year I went down there I did that. I got a little more adventurous, but the guys I work with, Paul Halloran and Tim Wilkin and Anthony Affronti, we're looking for something new. So,
well,
if they have me back next year, which I hope they will, and
I'm
all
sure
signs point to that, hopefully we'll I'll hook up and I'll get something good from you.
Well, first of all, so you stay up in Ben Salem?
Yeah, we stay. There's a little hotel like right across from the track. That's right there. So, so they put us up right there. Handy for getting back and forth to the backstretch and that. So, we live in a car and everything. So.
Well, all right. Then, as mentioned, Non Solo Pasta, which is a favorite of tons of horsemen. And it's about 18 minutes from Parks. Township. It's literally just across. It's still in Pennsylvania, but it's very close to the Jersey border.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm,
Morrisville. I think it's Morrisville is the township or the town. And John Service. You'll see John Service there. You'll see Butch and Ginny Reed. You will see former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. And you can imagine how good the food is if it's one of Chris Christie's favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does he wear his baseball uniform?
As long as he doesn't wear what he wore on the beach that day, I'm sure he's welcome.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Morrisville. All right, Morrisville. Good to know. So I think there's a Morrisville in every state in America. It's like a Springfield, right? I mean, there's a Morrisville in New York, right?
There's Morrisville between, between Cazenovia and Hamilton, right on Route 20.
That's right.
The home of SUNY Morrisville.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And the home of many, many, a Madison County trooper or state police.
I've had run
dragnet for college students, for Colgate students. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they got me. The New York State troopers got me the other day going down to Queens. I was on the Taconic Parkway, and I knew better, but I was going a little too fast. So they got me in Austerlitz, of all places.
Austerlitz is very dangerous. They'll grab you at the north end of the Taconic. I've got the greatest Taconic ticket story ever.
Oh, nice.
All right. This involves a car that I had bought in the late 80s. When I saw the Bonneville SSE, it's the only time in my whole life that I saw a car and said, I have got to have that car. And so I went. So whenever I traded, it had to be, I want to say it was 88. And so I went and got, we used to go to Scranton Motors in Vernon, Larry Scranton, the late Larry Scranton. And I got maybe three cars in a row from Larry Scranton. And so I get the Bonneville. And this was a car that if you touched the accelerator, you were going 90. It was
big boat, right? Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And it was low to the ground. And it was a racing machine. And not that I'm a gearhead or ever was, but it was so much fun to drive. So I'm pretty sure I was working for Dan and Yogurt at the time. And I used to have to come up to John's Dairy in Albany. And I remember I was coming back from Albany, and I'm on the Taconic because I was living in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was, you know, the Taconic. If you're in a hot car, and you like to drive, the Taconic is fun.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So I'm going way too fast for the Taconic, and sure enough, here are the rollers, and so I quickly pull over. And the Taconic's not a great place because you know there's no very little shoulder, so I
pulled over.
Yeah, wherever I could. And the the trooper comes out, and I got the window down, and he says, "This is the SSE, right? This is the new Bonneville." Why, yes, it is. And I said, "Do you want it?" I said, "Here, check it out." And he wanted to sit in it. We opened the hood. He just wanted to see the car.
Oh man.
That's a true story.
He got out of the ticket?
Oh, you know, there was never even a ticket discussed.
Nice. You didn't even ask for the license? Nothing.
Nothing. He just wanted to see the car.
Man. Well.
Oh, my God.
They had no interest in my Mazda the other day, so, yeah. Nine to dozen.
Well, I got one around the time of pandemic going north, and that was in Austerlitz, and, thank goodness for the pandemic, because the thing was delayed so long that eventually I got it down to failure to yield to street signs.
Yeah. Parked on highway or something like that. Yeah,
yeah, right. some ridiculous thing with court costs.
I love it. Yeah, the tickets are like, the court costs are cost more than the ticket, you know?
Yeah.
I was excited for that. So that was, oh, well.
Well,
I hadn't driven a lot. You know, I've been in Saratoga, like, when you're doing the the meet, I basically drive from my house to the office to the track, and kind of like, I mean, a lot of times I just ride my bike or I walk, or, you know, I'm on foot. So I hadn't really gone anywhere in like a couple months. Like, all fired up, I guess.
Well,
going to
exactly.
A concert down in Florida.
Leadfoot.
Yeah.
Leadfoot, right?
Yep. Yeah, then they like lecture you and everything. It's like, okay, you know, I guess he's giving me the ticket. And my girlfriend's like, you didn't even, like, when he finished, like, he just handed you the ticket and you, like, didn't say anything. I'm like, what am I supposed to say? He's like, I don't know. You say thank you. I'm like, I'm not thanking him for giving me a ticket. I mean, I wasn't a jerk about it, but I'm like, you know.
Well, I got out of one coming back from Kentucky. I was in Northern Ohio late at night after leaving Iroquois Pocahontas Day, and I wanted to get as far north as I could, and I was zipping along, and guy pulls me over, and it turned out it was not an Ohio trooper; it was a county Mountie, and he said to me, "Listen," he said, "where are you headed?" I said, "I'm trying to get to Ashtabula tonight."
Yeah,
he said, "Well." He said, "You're going too fast, and the state troopers will hammer you." He said, "I can't give you a ticket, but slow down." Mm. So that was nice. And Tina got me out of one in Columbus one year.
Nice.
Coming back from Derby.
Surprised you're speed in Columbus with all the construction usually going on.
Well, exactly. It was post. It was post Derby, and we had stopped. When you did Derby and Latonia and whatnot. Walt Hitching Post? You ever go to Walt Hitching Post?
Sure. Yeah.
I took Tina to Walt's. And so we were behind a couple of hours than we usually, you know, trying to get up to Mentor or, you know.
Washington Courthouse.
Well, now further than Courthouse. Yeah. You gotta get north of Columbus.
Yeah,
because then we'll stop and see the kids in Rochester. But a guy pulls me over in just where 71 hits Columbus, and you start to come around the eastern side, you know, the east side of the belt. And so the guy says, you know, I pulled you over. And Tina goes, "Let me answer that."
I like that. He was like, he's going to get it worse from her than he's going to get it from me.
Exactly. And so she got him laughing, and because she said, "Let's see, he changed lanes without signal. He's going too fast," and the cop starts to laugh, and he said, "All right, where are you headed?" I said, "She said we're just leaving Derby, and we're trying to get to Northern Ohio."
Yeah, I love it.
I've never thought to add up all the times I might have been cited.
Yeah,
as a traffic. Well,
I got
staffer.
One in Cleveland, right? When I moved to back to Saratoga from Lexington, I had a U-Haul, and I got one in near Cleveland, like where the speed zone changes like every mile. It's like 55 to 65 to 50 to back to 65, and I got pulled over in the U-Haul. And I was like, "This thing has a governor on it, doesn't it?" And he was like, "Well, that's apparently not good enough."
In a U-Haul? How do you...
In a U-Haul, of all things.
You get ticketed in a U-Haul. Oh, that's hysterical.
I know. I was so mad. Yeah, it was great.
That's pretty funny.
U-Haul. Yeah, so now, you know, it's funny. You're not, and then you're careful, right? So then every time you go through that area, you're like, "Ooh, I remember this. I got to be careful here." So I guess if you rack it up enough, you're kind of like, you're careful everywhere, man.
Well, yeah, I've mentioned, you know, having lived in a lot of places.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, south of Kansas City. If you're heading down, you know, toward Oklahoma or, you know, straight south. I want to say Spring Hill is the town. I think there's a notorious. Notorious speed. That, I mean, any salesman that ever worked Western Missouri is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when if you work anywhere in that, you know, from Omaha to Des Moines to St. Louis to Columbia to Springfield to Jeff City, down to Tulsa, Wichita. You get stretches of road. You know, that just invites you to go 95. I mean, it's crazy. I used to have to go to places like Manhattan, Kansas, and Junction City, Kansas. Crazy. Yeah. And you know, it's like out of a movie. You see a road just without, you know, there's not a hill and there's not a left or a right. For 200 miles.
It's just baiting you right into it.
Exactly. Well, you baited me into all kinds of far-fetched conversation.
We don't talk for a while.
Exactly. Let's get the elephant out of the room, first of all. The turf course situation, Tom, and I didn't notice if you had to issue a statement, but this was, for a horse to end up, you know, perishing, this was really a disaster, honestly.
Yeah, so like I said, I get contracted by the track to handle the publicity and kind of send out a lot of the track notes and, you know, stories about the racing and kind of the feel-goody stories, but always with the back of my mind that there could be an instance where something has to be done that's of a serious nature, obviously.
Sure.
Thought about it a lot last year in the wake of everything that happened at Churchill and Saratoga, horses breaking down and a lot of the problems that we had. And then, of course, then they had the real rainy day there last year and, you know, tracks canceling all over the East Coast and they opted to run. I was just kind of like, okay, well, they're going ahead, you know, I mean, hats off to them, and they end up having a, you know, incident-free day last year, fortunately, and, you know, big handle day. Obviously, they were the only track running. And then this year, of course, they run the two races, the card, the two races on the grass. They've had a lot of problems with their turf course. You know, the horsemen are upset about it, and then they run the Alphabet Soup and the Turf Monster. They card the two races for the grass, and, you know, I'm not a track superintendent at all, but looking at it, it didn't look great, but and unfortunately they had a breakdown in the Alphabet Soup, and, you know, then I have to go into sort of PR man mode, I guess. You know, a lot of people in the press room are asking me about what happened, and you know, so I'm just relaying, you know, basically what the track wants me to say. You know, at first, you know, nobody knew exactly what happened other than the horse pulled up and vanned off. Later, you know, learned, I guess, that some of the press did their homework and talked to the connections and found out that the horse passed away or had to be euthanized. And then obviously the track, I went upstairs and said, you know, what are you guys going to do here? They were already meeting about it, talking about it. And I said, you know, you probably got to put something out. You know, so they basically said that they took the Turf Monster off the grass. It was an unfortunate situation. Obviously, unfortunate that then they had a Turf Monster race that was an older horse sprint race going 5 furlongs for a huge purse. You know, I'm sure they would have liked to maybe use some of that money for the purse account in different ways than what it ended up being used for. But they got some work to do on that turf course. I think they're going to have to. I think they're going to address it, hopefully, going forward.
It just occurred to me because, you know, you mentioned having to put out a statement with them. Did Heisa issue in the wake of their involvement and their oversight? Did they issue a statement?
They haven't said anything in the wake of it, but I got the sense that, and again, this is just speculation by me from my conversations, but I got the sense that maybe Heise was going to force their hand and tell him to do it, and maybe the jockeys as well might have refused to ride in the turf race as well. Anecdotally, I heard that the jockeys were meeting after the race with a representative of the guild that was there.
Well, and I understand that Johnny Velasquez was not there at the moment. I understand Johnny got involved.
Yeah, I heard that too. So, that to me that means that either one of those parties was going to do something about it. And Parks obviously felt like they needed to do it first. So.
Well, we'll talk to Tony too. Tony's going to join us next. And Tony and I had talked about it, in the wake of the original circumstances that saw racing on the grass suspended, and until at the very least the holes were patched. At the time I mentioned because it is one of those teachable moments. When people don't understand why races come off the turf, races don't come off the turf in inclement weather because there's a concern per se that moment, that day is dangerous. That day is not dangerous. Horses, as everybody knows, and anybody that watches racing, from Europe, softish turf, a lot of horses love, and they run
on it a lot over there,
right?
Yeah,
and they go slower, and it's not dangerous. What's dangerous is the divots and the stabbing into the ground that horses make on soft turf that then hardens and becomes death traps for other horses to step into later. That's why races come off the grass.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you see it with, I think you saw it here at Saratoga a couple years ago. They ended up, the really strange circumstances where horses are in the paddock or they're in the post parade, and all of a sudden we just get this crazy biblical rain, and then they're running these races on top of the grass course that are when the rain was coming down, and they ended up with some problems probably with the grass course. Just because we run six or seven races a day on it here at Saratoga, which to me always makes me sort of cringe a little bit when you hear all this talk about running the meet up here for X number more days. If they're forcing all these grass races, to run, or it's the only way they can get these cards to go. I mean, I don't know how they can possibly even entertain it. When you look at the condition of the courses by the end of the meet, and that happens everywhere, but especially here where we get this severe weather that we have lately. But yeah, I mean, that's the, they run on bottomless ground in Europe all the time, like you said, but they don't run on it the next day. they might run it on in the Curra, and then they won't run at the Curra again for 2 months. So it has a chance to take more rain, level itself out a little bit more, fills in those holes, and you get some more growth. But with American racing, the way it's set up, you're not able to do that.
The same holds true. We had the conversation with Nick Nicholson at Kentucky Downs, and for the people that would love to see Kentucky Downs run, whatever, 10 cards, let's say, they've got a similar issue. Even with three temporary rail settings, you just can't. The volume of horses and the volume of races that they run, it's just not. And of course, the course can't take it. That's why And let's be honest, Churchill and Keeneland, don't necessarily want to give up extra dates to Kentucky Downs. But at the same time, there's also the matter of you know, the money that is being generated and that has to be distributed. So there's a couple different forces at work, but one of the bugaboos involved here is the actual condition of the grass. And this was the craziest Kentucky Downs season ever, when they did not get rain essentially for 17 days. There was that one night, the Friday night before the big weekend, when I'd gotten there on Wednesday. There was the one night when there was some nice rain. So,
yeah, I mean, they got lucky, right? I mean, normally you feel like every year at Kentucky Downs, you're like, hey, they had to cancel. You know, they're going to run Tuesday instead of Monday. You know, because they got this deluge of rain. Typical of hurricane season or whatever might affect them, which obviously is probably going to happen this weekend. They were fortunate. They were able to not have to reschedule or do any of that. Same as us here, Saratoga. We finally got some rain. Some rain today. But it had been like 16 days. You know, for those of you listening that can't believe it, if you're ever here in the summer. You'd think that was impossible. You barely get 15 minutes without rain. It seems like in the summer, but yeah, we've been pretty fortunate this fall. Everything's dry and dusty.
I appreciate I appreciate you dealing with the tough topic. Let's talk about the results. And I started the show by including the Adair Manor news from yesterday, Tom. Here's Torpedo Anna. Not a stronger path, it seems. She's going to, with Adair Manor being retired and sold, Torpedo Anna's going to be, the major. There's idiomatics out there, but she doesn't seem to be as formidable as she was a year ago. Anyway, thoughts about the two features.
Well, I mean, yeah, Torpedo Anna obviously was the star of the show. You know, it's Pennsylvania Derby Day, but it was really, / Cotillion Day this year, for sure, with her. Kenny McPeak obviously conceded after the race that maybe he didn't have her fully cranked, and that's why she, didn't blow him away like she typically does. But, nice horses that she had to run against, and the circumstances, the riders did their best to put her in some spots where they could maybe take advantage of the circumstances, kind of bottle her up. Tarifa had her, Flavian Pratt had Tarifa just to her outside, and, you're looking to maybe Gunsung or Mystic Lake back up into her, and she's not able to get out, and maybe they take her chance there. But Tarifa, Pratt told me after, he says he just didn't have enough to hold her off. To hold her in there as long as he would have liked, and then Gunsung really responds really well down the lane and finishes pretty evenly and doesn't throw in the towel at all and finishes second at a huge price, for a filly that has put together some decent races over the years and had won over the season and had won there. Hats off to Torpedo Anna for winning the way she did. They don't all have to win by, daylight lengths and fast times every single time they run. She's obviously capable of doing that. We've seen it. I don't think you'd really want a super hard race where you blow it out or you have to really dig in deep to win going into the ultimate goal, which is the Breeders' Cup at the end of the season. So, I've seen some of the videos that Kenny's put out the last few days about her bouncing out of the race, and she's showing every sign you want to see here at Saratoga. Going to train here for the distaff, so it's pretty exciting. I'm going to go out there and see her once the rain stops.
Sure.
It'll be nice, to go have that opportunity. It's always cool when the Breeders' Cup horses are here in Saratoga, which we've seen a lot of the last several years. And anxious to go see her again, run out in California. He'll take her show on the road again. It's going to be tough to beat her.
Well,
you asked me about in the Derby. I mean, you want to talk about Sean Wright, Wayne, of course, Wayne Lucas was you know, being on the notes team, a lot of the horses ship in kind of the day of, or they, you know, they come in maybe 2 days before. They might train one day. So you end up, we end up spending a lot of time talking on the phone with some of these guys. I went out to Saratoga and talked to Todd Pletcher about his horses, and Tim was, did the same with Bill Mott and Zappy Joseph and guys like that that were shipping from here. But Wayne was there all week, so, you know, we got to go out and see him, and of course, you know, he held court the way Wayne likes to hold court. And, he never lacks for confidence. But he was pretty confident in his horse there. And, you know, the way the race shook out, with Dragoon Guard, you know, not really breaking that great, didn't really get away too great, and nobody really pressed. Sees the Gray gets off to, you know, 49-1 to the half. You knew he was going to be pretty tough. He was pretty tough and at Pimlico, obviously on a much different racetrack than he faced in the Pennsylvania Derby, but, you know, he was headed at the top of the lane and looked like maybe he might throw in the towel, and he just sort of was resurgent down the lane and ends up winning by almost four lengths. I thought that was pretty impressive. When I looked at the chart later, I was like, whoa, holy cow. I didn't realize he drew away like that. But, you know, sees the Gray, puts his name back in the mix for the, I guess, the three-year-old male title. You know, you look at all
sure.
the who's won what and number of grade ones and grade twos and, you know, but, you know, they don't give out the titles for in September or October, you know, so we got to see what happens in the Breeders' Cup, but he's got every reason to give his connections, and there's a lot of connections, obviously. We saw them all spill out onto the racetrack, the My Racehorse people. They got to be pretty happy going into the Breeders' Cup, whatever race they decide to run in, you know. I would think Wayne's going to run in the Classics, but just knowing how he operates, and he's aggressive, you know, so I mean, why wouldn't you? I don't think anybody's really scaring you off in there. I mean, unless you feel like the City of Troy and maybe the Japanese horses are world beaters, but you know, those Japanese horses didn't exactly light it up yesterday, from what I understand.
Yeah, we watched that, and I mean, I wouldn't put much. I don't know. I wouldn't discount them based on
no,
on the prep.
Based on that little prep race, yeah.
And I mean, if you're against Forever Young, who's going to come into it without apparently a prep?
Yeah.
That's a different story. It's funny you say that about the, you know, choosing the mile or the.
Yeah.
Or the Classic, because Andy yesterday, today's Thursday, Andy on Tuesday said, you know, like Wayne is going to bypass the Classic. Kind of scoffed at that a little bit, but.
And he's got, I mean, there's all kinds of kickers in the Stallion deal. You know, I'm sure there's different kickers for the Classic versus the.
Well, no,
trial.
Apparently. Not the way he worded it. I mean, I guess we could find out, but the way he worded it was for winning a Breeders' Cup race.
Oh, okay.
So he didn't necessarily specify.
Yeah.
I maybe, you know, you would think there'd be a distinction, but maybe not. Maybe not.
Yeah. Well, the dirt mile is what, 1 million, right? Versus the Classic is what, 6?
Yeah.
There's a pretty good incentive, but.
Well,
you know, a mile and a quarter, I guess, is on that track. You know, that's the track to try it, I guess.
Well, and yeah, with the stretch, I mean, the way it is, would play to. You would think it would play to his advantage that way. Torres deserves. I brought that up with Wayne on Monday. I mean, Torres deserves tremendous credit.
Agreed. You know, and they deserve a lot of credit for sticking with him. You know, I mean, he lost the two races, but it wasn't his fault when he lost the races. But, you know, Wayne seemed to think that the horse had a genuine excuse in the Jim Dandy. But, you know, he did a great job, I think. You know, he's pretty poised, you know, for his experience winning that race, and made all the right moves in the Pennsylvania Derby. Made all the right moves in the Preakness, too, and in the Pat Day Mile, for that matter. You know, held that horse together pretty good after being pretty close to a fast pace in that race that time. Yeah, he's doing well. Nice kid. You know, I enjoyed talking to him the brief amount of time I had talking to him after the race. It was fun. He's the future, I guess. He's a pretty solid rider.
It's been a particularly good year. Not that the big names, not that, you know, particularly Flavian Pratt and Irad and even Frankie Dettori to an extent, not that they haven't, you know, garnered the headlines, but it's been a very good year for journeymen. And if you characterize Torres that way, Dylan Davis, Brian Hernandez Jr., I would put in Ramon Vasquez. It's been a really notable on that front, right? That it has not just been the usual suspects when it comes to the highest level and the biggest wins.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about a tough year for Eclipse Award voting, right? I mean, hopefully people don't just zero in on the stats list and all that. You got to really dig deep and dissect it. You know, I mean, you look at Hernandez winning the Oaks and the Oaks and Derby double, I mean, historic type stuff, and you know the jobs he does on Torpedo Anna is just amazing. And
well, he would have been a whipping boy if she had gotten beat Saturday.
Oh yeah,
they'd be calling right. They'd be calling for his head.
Oh yeah. And you mentioned Dylan. I mean, talk about a great year for him. I mean, he's still rolling. Just a great kid, great guy, you know, works hard at it, and, you know, he's persevered. You know, speaking of parks, you know, he's got his agent out of the parks, and now they're rolling. Hats off to those guys, for sure.
Yeah, you made one reference that I got to wrap with. The three-year-old male championship.
Yeah.
There's been plenty of debate this week. About not even necessarily just the you know, the players, Fierceness and Seas and Dornick, and Andy had a great what if, which is if Sierra Leone were to win the Classic. But the merits of the Grade Ones, the Classics, and then the summer. You could call them quasi-classics. Haskell, Travers, Pennsylvania Derby, the three other grade ones, which to me should have some sort of an overwrap around them. I've been calling for that for decades. Crazy that you have a secondary summer triple crown and nobody's made an attempt to tie them together. Because people love that kind of a series. Anyway, when evaluating the merits, Tom, of resumes, this is a really fun scenario. I mean, in terms of, because I think people are going to, you know, Mystic Dan is sort of, you know, has an incomplete. If he was a college student, it's an incomplete because of,
didn't finish out the year. Right.
Yeah. So it leaves us with, you know, the Belmont winner, the Preakness winner, the Travers winner, who also won the Florida Derby, et cetera. Where do you, if you had to rank them right now, you know, pre-classic, how do you rank them?
I would put Fierceness on top. You know, his Florida Derby, and then was huge. I mean, obviously, good circumstances for him in there. And then his Travers, I mean, he beat Seas de Grey in the Jim Dandy. He beat Dornick in the Travers. He also beat the filly, who might end up being Horse of the Year, in the Distaff, or in the Travers, who if she was to run the table in the Distaff. I guess you ask me right now. You know, the Travers, I think, was as good a race as there has been this year. You know, it's a better race than the Pennsylvania Derby. Let's face it. It's a better race than the, minus Mind Frame. It's a better race than the Haskell. So I would rank him number one. And I think I would put Dornick two. you know, Belmont Haskell double, pretty tough, you know, even though his last race was not very good. And then probably sees the gray third. But it's they're pretty close together, you know, and I think Andy's point about Sierra Leone, that he throws a serious wrench into it. I think some people might be inclined to vote for him, but some people probably would not. So then we're almost back to where we are now, if that were to happen. You know, Bluegrass Stakes / Breeders' Cup Classic, you know, pretty similar. I mean, obviously the Breeders' Cup Classic is the biggest purse of all those races that everybody has won. But maybe his losses in the middle. I think it's going to take care of itself. I don't think he's winning the Classic, but yeah, he could. I mean, I hope he takes money. I've done well betting against him this year. So, yeah, that's it's a tough one this year, which is good, right? I mean, it gives us something to talk about. Hopefully, maybe everything shakes out kind of cool, and we can have a little bit of suspense going into the Eclipse Awards. Sure beats the alternative going into the Eclipse Awards other years when we're talking about other things that are unrelated to the racetrack as of this year. But
yeah. It's been fun. It's been racetrack. It's been what's been on the ovals.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Talk racing, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
100%.
Yeah, fun. And you know, we'll see. You know, as you mentioned, I mean, Adair Manor being, you know, the first chip to fall. I mean, there's always a lot of attrition at this time
of
year. You know,
that's a good point.
You know, it feels like every year, you know, you're like, oh, this horse is out. Hopefully it doesn't happen. You know, don't wish any good misfortune on anybody. But a lot of guys, they just time to retire. You know, maybe he's not quite going into the race as well as I thought he is. So he's got a little bit of a soft tissue injury. Maybe he's got to be retired. Rather than throw in a bad race or something. But hopefully we don't see a lot of that this year. But it feels like inevitably there always is a lot of that.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I suppose we can also weave into one other horse and one other topic that you know the people have been, I think, has kind of captured people's imagination, and that is what to do next with Next. And we talked to Doug Cowens the other morning, and you know, the fact that there's no Thoroughbred Aftercare or Las Vegas Marathon this year is opened the door for him and his owner to, you know, have to really consider the Classic, and they threw the turf in because of you know, Doug feels the distance is his friend, and you know that he would be, I think, based on what I kind of heard from him talking the other morning, I think he's leaning to the turf because of the mile and a half.
Yeah, it's funny that they're in the situation that they're in. I never really got a real understanding as to why they eliminated the marathon race and they added a 2-year-old race at 1 mile on the grass. Yeah, there's not enough of those. Talk about boring. Versus, you know, this is the year to make that change when you have a horse like Next. I don't know if they're, you know, I don't know if they think this far ahead to force his hand or whatever, but, you know, him running in the turf is interesting because, as you know, the way that race is typically run, it's not really like it's kind of a galloper's race for a little while, and then it's like very frantic and fast at the end. The way it was European, if it sets up like a European style turf race, which they've done well in it over the years, that's not really Next style per se. But you know, maybe he's like a Bucks boy or something like that, where he just got out there.
Bucks
kind of
boy,
doing it
look
all.
At you, look at you. Yeah. Look at the big brain on Tom.
Well, I've seen a lot of them. I've been to a lot of them. You know, I've kind of you draw comparisons based on what you've seen in the past. So it can be done. You know, and then there's all the talk about him running the Classic and you got to do this. You know, I've always been a firm believer in, you know, he's their horse. They don't owe it to anybody to do anything with him. I mean, he's awesome and he's fun and he gives them great joy, and the horse has great joy doing what he's doing. You can tell. You know, I hate to see him go out of his game. You know, but at the same time, they want to run him. You know, I can't blame them for wanting to run him, but I don't understand why they got rid of that race. Herbert at the Caroline should step up and say, we want to leave it a mile and a half. What could be better, a second career for a horse like Next, to run these mile and a half races or mile and three quarters? Not really a second career. He's still in his first career, but I don't know. But, yeah, he's cool. You know, like I said, I think during the meet, he was the one horse I was sitting in the office, and we were busy. It was right before sales time. It was a super busy day, and I remember just saying, I got to go over there and watch Next. You know, I had, like, shorts and a T-shirt on. And the only other time I went over in shorts and a T-shirt was for the dunk tank that I did for Best. I went over there
I got your message way after. Was it you or no? It was Aaron Yagoda who asked me about being a candidate for the dunk tank. So I guess next year.
Oh, you got to do it, man. You got to do it. It was fun. You can talk smack. It's not easy. People really miss. You know, Joe Clancy, he was whiffing like crazy. Some of the other interns on our staff, they were missing. It was great. It was fun, you know, all for charity. And now that I'm off the hook, I don't have to do it again. I did it once, so now it's your turn. It'll be great. I'll be over there. I'll be winging that ball. I'm not much of a thrower, but I'm okay. I played baseball as a kid, so, yeah.
Well, Tom, this was comprehensive. I appreciate.
Yeah, all the always fun to talk. I think maybe next time we'll talk, I'll be either on my way to Keeneland. I'm one of the judges for the Godolphin Thurbert Industry Employee Awards. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Second weekend, right after the second weekend of the meet down there. So I'm headed down, and I think I'm going to stay down there and fly to the Breeders' Cup right from there in Lexington. So I'll get a good chunk of the Keeneland meet. So I'm looking forward to that.
Tom Law, everybody. Saratoga TL. And he was kind enough to table his kayak ride, his mountain climbing, his paragliding, his snowshoeing, his marathon running to join us this morning.
Appreciate the time, Steve. I'm going for a run.
I love it. Tom Law, everybody. And next year I will absolutely come downstairs and visit the media. He called it the media room. It's a like a media corridor that that gets cordoned off. But they do a good job on that front. I mean, the TV coverage, of course. You know, we talked to Dick Girardi the other morning, which was a lot of fun. And Will Schwartz told a very funny Dick Girardi story. Will was, I guess maybe over the summer, or I think over the summer, it was the Winner's Circle or the Paddock, and you know, hot day, and Will, I think Will, you know, was wearing, you know, nice summer shorts, and they wouldn't let him in the paddock. And then he looks over, and there's Dick Girardi. And I God bless Dick. You know, he's not known for the sartorial, you know, elegance. he very typically, you know, he's wearing, you know, he's wearing, let's be honest, they're like gym warm-ups shorts. and you know, he comes from the Bill Belichick school of of sideline apparel. And that was true actually on Saturday. When I saw him on Saturday too, he was let's just say slightly underdressed. I think is the is the best way to put it. So Will told me that story and it made me laugh. And then no sooner did he say it, did he tell the story. There's Dick, which did surprise me a little bit. Dick, one of the top, like we talked yesterday about the contest, Dick, a top flight contest player. He'll be, you'll see him on the, you'll absolutely see him on the leaderboard of BCBC almost every year. He's in the hunt. Let's hunt up, Brian, let's hunt up Tony. Well, might as well coda, the Derby Cotillion Day conversation with Tony Black. And as we wait, I will mention, I just reached out to Courtney Reed at Breeders' Cup about the marathon. And I'm not sure it's not so much a Breeders' Cup. I don't know if it's a Breeders' Cup topic or if it's in this case, a Del Mar Racing Office topic. Hammer, if you're listening, maybe you can... Maybe Hammer can weigh in on this. If I don't get an answer by tomorrow, we will have Hammer weigh in on it. But, you know, it. How many years did they run? What, 3 years maybe? The marathon? How long did they run that race? As a Breeders' Cup race. And then it got this, you know, this quasi-status, you know, as part of a, you know, Breeders' Cup adjacent. Well, now I've got to look and see if there's an answer. You know, there's been any number over the years of even the steeplechase. There was the Breeders' Cup steeplechase for a couple of years. Let's see here. There is a distinction between Breeders' Cup Marathon. 6 years. It was run six times, starting in 2008. 2008 to 2013. Mahonik, for Rafe Beckett, Patrick Smulin, Man of Iron, who you might remember, Maiden O'Brien, with Johnny Murtaugh. And it seemed like he could not. Yeah, I mean, he seemed like a real lock. Eldefer, that was so, how funny, Eldefer, God, I'd forgotten about him, with Johnny, a fleet again, Butchie Reed, with Cornelio Velasquez, Kaleidoscopio, who was a lot of fun, Aaron Grider. Whenever we talk to Aaron, we always bring up Kaleidoscopio for Guillermo Frenkel, and then London Bridge, I completely forgot about this horse, holy cow. London Bridge won the last running in 2013. And so then it became, it was the Las Vegas Marathon for a couple of years, several years, I think. And then TAA took over. So anyway, we'll find out what happened here. Tony Black.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Steve Beck. How you doing? I got to apologize. This is one of the few Thursdays I haven't been listening because I had to get some things done here, and I don't know how I let myself get involved in taking care of some things at the house instead of listening to Steve.
No, it's fine. It's better. It's better that you didn't hear Tom Law, because we already talked. Tom and I talked. You know, he took care of the media things last week at Parks, and so we hit a bunch of those topics. And so it'll be fresh. Whatever your perspective is. You're not going to be reacting to what Tom had to say. You can react to what went on Saturday. And by the way, you and I saw each other for about 3 minutes. It was a crazy afternoon.
It really was. You know, there's a lot of lot going on, and then I was there with my son, and he keeps taking me around and asking me a million questions. Yeah, I think I even forgot to eat. I'm not sure. I don't know. So, but it was a kind of a packed house, and
sure.
And they had a, I guess they had good handle. I think they handled like $16 million or something. I forget what Kylie tells me all those facts, you know. But the Cotillion was, you know, of course, I thought that was a really good race. The Derby was, you know, it was all right. Derby, yeah. You know, I thought they could. There wasn't any really heavy heads that I knew in there, but it was a good day. A lot of fun being there, and it makes me get over there and have contact with people that I had ridden for or people that knew that I was a rider all those years. So they didn't let me forget that I knew that I rode there for many, many years.
A couple of things, Tony. Start with the let's start for a second with the Derby. We all of us that handicapped all week long, and of course they had the early draw, and so you get to look at this race 16 different ways, and it just seemed like a spot where there had to be pace, and there had to be, you know, a legit pace, and then Torres gets to steal the race the same way he stole the Preakness, and nobody confronts him.
Yeah, you know, that's like rider air. You know, people get to looking at riders. You know, being in the jocks room for a lot of years, I kind of know riders. Riders look at a race and they'll see that there's multiple speed horses in the race, and you know, they might be on one of them. And what gets me is right off the bat, they say, "Oh, this is going to be a hot pace. We're going to wind up sitting. I'm going to sit and I'm going to just try to get a position and stalk and stalk and stalk." And you know, and I never fell into that trap. If there was multiple speed horses in the race, sometimes that's when you make the easiest lead, because everybody's sitting and you be determined to go. And if you do go and somebody goes with you, maybe after the eighth quarter of a mile, they'll sit if you keep going, you know, because they don't want to burn themselves out. Now, the whole thing about it is it depends on the kind of horse that you want. If it is a horse that enjoys being in a tactical front position or close position, if it's a horse that you can, you know, get ready, leave the gate, jack him up, leave in there, and then he has enough intelligence to settle down after he goes eighth a mile or so, and you can reel him back in. That's a horse that fits into a race, and he's intelligent, and he lets you utilize him efficiently and effectively. But on many occasions, you know, you wind up riding these horses, and you get them out of there and jack them up, leave in there, but you can't put them back to you know, an average pace where you can't put them back to sleep. So it depends on the kind of horse that you're on. You know, there are horses that really respond to your hands and what you want them to do. They respond well. And then there are horses that at times are complete runoffs. You know, you get them rolling, leaving there, and you don't get them back to sleep. But, you know, it's amazing how the riders make the mistake at times when they see there's multiple speed horses in a race, and they say, "Oh, well, I'm not going to get in one of these speed jams." Well, you know what? Sometimes you got to let them go, leave in there, and then you decide what to do. Over-strategizing a race, I know when I was a rider, over-strategizing a race caused me to ride some of the worst races of my career. And going with it and letting it unfold in front of you the way it may, and not over-strategizing, sometimes made you ride a good race, and you utilized your horse efficiently and effectively, and they really responded well to that type of handling.
It always reminds of the Alan Jerkins line about the Rich tells it, you know, about Jerkins questioning a jock trying to rate a speed horse, and Alan saying horses have been running away, been using their speed for you know, thousands of years, and I get a jock trying to change evolution.
Yeah. Yeah, what a great guy, you know. I mean, he was a great guy to ride for, because he understood that it's things that happen out there aren't always easily explained by his view of the race or your explanation after the race. I'll never forget one day he said, sent his assistant trainer, and I don't think I ever told you this story. He sent his assistant trainer and his trainer to, it was Laurel I was at. I was riding down there steady. And he came down there. He sent this horse that had been laid off for a while, and he said, his assistant trainer said, did you talk to Alan? I said, yeah, just briefly on the phone. He said, well, this horse, he says, you all understand, you know, he's really not ready. We're getting him ready, and we want to get him in some easier spots. So just get him around there and get a race into him and just let it unfold as it may. Well, okay, I kind of left there and, you know, had a no-pressure attitude and let this horse just kind of track the field the way he felt like and was comfortable. And when I come to the head of the lane, I said, he'll be done now, because it was 7/8 mile race, and he was, you know, and really, they said, he's only ready to go about, you know, 5/8, you know. And I said, that's all right. So I kind of like just let him lie in there, and I figured when he comes apart, he comes apart. And then when he came apart, he didn't come apart. They came back to him in his face. I had to swing him out, and he run past him like a freight train passing a bum on the side of railroad tracks. And the assistant trainer, when I got to the winner's circle, he looked at me, and he, like, with one of these expressions, like, what the hell were you doing? And when I got off the horse, he threw the program at me. I said, he says, Alan was getting this horse ready to run for, like, 10,000, 15,000. He said, this was 25,000 today. I said, well, he win like he can win for 30. He won like he can win an allowance race. He says, yeah. You guys, you always think you know more than the trainer. I said, nobody knows more than Alan. I says, Richie, but, you know, he was his assistant trainer for a lot of years. I said, I'm just telling you, this horse was readier than you thought he was, and he'll win for 30. He'll win an A other than. Well, he wound up, this horse, I don't even want to tell you the name of the horse. Not only won for 30. And that was for whatever that cheap race was. He won an A other than, two other than, three other than, and I finished fourth on him in the Trenton and got beat 5 lengths at Garden State Park. So even the greatest sometimes can underestimate the value of their horse. And even the greatest trainer in the world is assistant trainer, Richie, don't always have to be 100% right. But, horses are amazing animals, you know. Sometimes they're not what you expect of them, and sometimes they can overachieve and surprise you to who they are, what they are, and how much they're worth.
And Tony, I'll fold into this something that Lucas said and on Monday, and some other, you know, it's come out from other quarters. And that is how deep that racetrack was, the main track on Saturday. And Lucas said, you know, because they had to take the picture with all the My Racehorse people, they had so many people to, you know, to get into the photograph. Bill Denver had to, you know, get them out there on the track. Lucas said until he walked out onto the apron there, he said he didn't realize how deep that track was. And frankly, the win, you know, the in this case by Seize the Gray, it actually kind of speaks to Lucas and the way he operates and having a dead fit horse.
Of course, that's so important when you get the ship into a track and you haven't trained there, you know, for to get a horse accustomed to a different type of racetrack, you know, especially when it comes to the depth of the racetrack and the tarring of the racetrack and how the track pulls on them. Or a racetrack that's compressed and no hardly any cushion. You don't do that sometimes. You can get a horse ready to run on a track that's extremely fast or packed or compressed or floated by just getting there that day or the day before. When you get on a track that's a deep racetrack, you have to train there more than a couple of days to get your horse accustomed to it. You know, not just the footing, but then the muscular fitness and what it takes for them to get across the racetrack. But, of course, you know, some animals take to change easier than others. But a deep racetrack is definitely tiring on a horse muscularly. And, you know, it's something that they have to train on like at least 7, 8, 9 days before they could say, oh, I got this horse dead fit for this kind of racetrack. But you know what? You shipped in the day before or 2 days before, and so have other horses just shipped in 2 days before, so they're in the same boat as you are. But sometimes that gives the horses training there on a daily basis or stable there a slight edge over you.
Well, and in this case, you know, Lucas, who who will put a horse through the paces, I think that's a fair way to place, you know, a fair way to characterize it. He had a horse that, you know, when other horses were feeling the burn, getting over that track, here was Seize the Gray that actually was widening at the end. Let's also, Tony, talk about the filly and the way in which Brian Hernandez Jr. had to be patient, and then when he basically couldn't be patient any longer, and when there was the moment where he saw for a stride or two, he saw the potential opening, and he wasn't waiting to see it get any bigger. He put her into that spot, and I think it's fair to say she kind of bulled her way through to, you know, gain the position she needed, you know, to reach the front. And you know, when you're on a horse at 1-9, you know, you at some point you're just going to do what you have to do to make a path for yourself.
Yeah, and you know, when you go out there and you're riding, and you're riding a horse that's supposed to win, you know, and of course she's a real racehorse. And he's ridden her before, so he knows what she can overcome. He knows, you know, he can have total confidence in who she is and what she's doing, and that plays into it. The one thing that I think that riders and horses can do that cause them not to run their best race, and it depends on the horse, of course, is setting in behind horses so long, especially on a deeper racetrack, you're getting hit with a lot of dirt. That can be discouraging at times for horses, and not giving them a clear shot in the early stages of the race, or not giving them a clear shot for a long part of that race, can really discourage horses. You know, there's only so much some of them will take when it comes to getting hit with dirt and traffic in front of them, and being boxed in and not able to move forward until, you know, the situation in front of you changes. But you got to give horses like her credit. I mean, when they run, they give it to you every time, and it doesn't matter what position they're in, I guess, because horses can get really discouraged easily by being in behind horses for long periods of time. It's the traffic in front of them that discourages them. It's the dirt hitting them. Dirt hitting horses, you know, especially on tracks that have a lot of cushion, can be one of the most discouraging things that a rider feels when he's on a horse that he knows, you know, because the horses are reacting to that dirt in a negative way. It's not causing them to, it's causing them to maybe not give you their best until you absolutely swing them out. And then if you can't swing them out and you make them eat it too long, sometimes when you swing them out, they're not giving you that big burst. So you have to ride them according to the way they feel under you. And sometimes you can't do that because you're in traffic. So you just have to make the best of the situation that you're in. And she's definitely, nobody has to tell you, she's a great racehorse. It's fillies and mares. Sometimes I had the opinion that they could be in an adverse position but give you their best run. And sometimes when you're on these colts and geldings, they could be in an adverse position for maybe too long, and they didn't always give you their best run. Fillies and mares, really, I thought they were my favorites to ride because they seemed to want to overcome. They were aggressive, and they were going to show you every time what kind of racehorse they were or they are.
Nice. I mean, because some horses, if they're being rated, they begin to sulk too, right? They
right. You know, the worst thing that I found out I could do on a horse is I muscle them back. And most of the time when you muscle them back, yeah, after a while you muscle them back to the point where they'll say, oh, you want me back here? I'll stay back here. Yeah. You know, fighting with them. You know, putting a stronger bit in their mouth, yeah, that's something that helps you at times to control a horse. But if you're using it to totally restrain a horse, you'll restrain them into submission sometimes. I mean, maybe I was too strong for my own good. But anytime I fought a horse so hard to get him in a position that I was told to get him in, most of the time that was the worst thing I could do for the outcome of the race. And a lot of times, you know, use a little strength, get them back, put them in that position if they were willing and you could do it without overly restraining them. When you overly restrain them, most of the time you restrain them right into submission. That was just my take on it.
No,
when I could come out of there, let them fall into my hands, maybe muscle them a slight bit, you know, put that bit in their mouth and make them come to where you wanted them to go. Yeah, at times it really worked, but when you had to do it to the point where, man, I'll show you where I want you to go, and I'll get this bit in your mouth, and I'll have you, yeah, you're lucky you got a nose band on, because your mouth would be wide open by the time I got done pulling on it. And most of the time, it didn't work, you know. Running into your hands and getting them to respond with some light restraint really worked best for me. I mean, you know, that was just for me. And I always liked when I'd use that light restraint, you know, kept them together, kept them balanced, you know, but I wasn't trying to pull them back and restrain them to the point of slowing them down. And getting their position, maybe it wasn't the exact position that the trainer wanted you in, but it was a decent position. And then their ears in the early stages of the race, I loved when you finally, like, relaxed on them, and then their ears started pricking back and forth. When you got them, when you got, especially if it was a horse that was near the lead or on the lead, once you put them where you wanted to put them and where they responded well to where you wanted to put them and their ears, and now you're relaxed on them and you're sitting there and their ears are going back and forth and they're just checking out what's around them or in front of them or to the side of them. But that's when you fired them up, wave the stick at them, and they take off running at the head of the stretch, and you can, most of the time, you know, you had a lot of horse to be finishing strong and maybe get the job done.
I love it. Excellent, Tony. Good. I wanted to take advantage of the two outcomes of the features on Saturday at Parks to talk about the way they ran and what you can glean from it. Now, before we go, though, I've got a terrific opportunity to test the old memory. We're gonna go back into the annals, and Bill Landis has got a question. He said, "Ask Tony about Charlie Jones' Asphalt Road."
Oh, Asphalt Road. That's a horse I do have a memory of, even though Asphalt Road was a horse that I rode in Maryland for Charlie Jones, and I think it was one of the first stake wins, the senatorial stake, and I think that was my first stake win ever.
Is that right?
I think Asphalt Road was my first stakes win, and was it at Laurel? I think Laurel.
It was Laurel. It was absolutely Laurel.
The senatorial stakes, and that was when you ran to the second wire, a mile 16th of the second wire. Is that right?
I can't tell you, but I can tell you when it was. It was December 4th, 1971.
Yeah, that was my first stake win. And you wound up at Laurel, they had a mile race out of a chute. You would go 1 mile, but it wasn't a straight chute. It was a bend. And then you would run now down the bend, down the backside to the first, to the 3/8 pole. And you, and the mile 16th, you'd run to the second wire. The first wire, that was what they used every day. And then the second wire was further down the stretch for the mile 16th races. And I think that was one of my first mile 16th wins at Laurel. And it was my first stake win on Asphalt Road, Charlie Jones, right?
Charlie Jones and his wife, is that his wife that owned it?
He was a cool guy, Charlie Jones. You know, I only rode a few horses for him, but I forget why I rode Asphalt Road. I think I wound up going down there either for a few days, or maybe it was when I I was after I lost the bug. I left guard state because I wasn't doing any good. I lost the bug. You said December 71. Yeah, because I lost the bug in June or July of 71. I started riding June 15th, 70. Win my fifth race the first week I was riding, so I started my bug. I had a year. And I had a year, and I lost the bug like in June or July of 71. Wasn't doing real good. And in those days, you know, when you lost the bug, you almost were told you couldn't really do real good. You'll have to learn really how to ride without that weight allowance, which is all BS. But I was riding at Garden State, wasn't doing any good, and then this agent says, let's go to Merlin. Let's go to Merlin. You know, you can get out of here. We ain't doing no good. And I went to Merlin and wound up, I think the first meet I was down there, I went with nobody and I was leading rider. And Vince Pacalli lost his bug and he had all the outfits to ride for. And like Dutrow and Tamaro and all those guys. And he had Steve Linakis, his hot agent. They said they were going to be leading rider. Well, I wound up being leading rider at Laurel. And I think that was one of the first stakes I won, the senatorial stakes.
How about that? And Bill's asking about Rube, your agent.
Rube. Who was my agent? Was it Eddie or Jimmy Cotter? I forget who my agent was. I remember some of the horses, but I forget who I left. Left Garden State with. I think it was Jimmy Cotter. I'm not sure, though.
All right.
It was Eddie Rubenstein. I'm not sure.
Well, this is pretty funny.
All I used to do is pay him. I didn't have a good relationship with all my agents.
Agents. This was a Maryland bred, and you've never mentioned this horse. That's pretty funny.
Sanatorial Stakes, Asphalt Road.
Yep. Yeah. It's sanatorial.
Yeah,
it was obscure.
Like I said, that was my first stake win, and it was to the second wire at Laurel. It was a bend, a turn, and to the second wire. And at times there were riders that rode, you know, and you didn't use the second wire all the time, but there was many a rider that stood up and was going to win a race and got to the first wire, stood up, and then, oh, there's another 16th of a mile to go, and they'd get back to riding. And some world-renowned riders did this. I don't even want to mention their names.
That's great.
I got to the second wire. I didn't stand up at the first wire, and I won on Asphalt Road. I don't think I won many races on him after that. I went a couple places and rode. He might have been in some stakes. The senatorial might have been a Merlin bred stake. I'm not sure.
Could be. I do see that his record is very incomplete on Equibase, but he did run in the Chaladin. The next spring, April of 72 at Pimlico, he was second.
Yeah, I forget. I rode him quite a few times, but I can't remember. Yeah, 71, boy, brings back some memories. The only thing
that?
Is, too many concussions in that.
Tony, outstanding. This was great.
All right, Steve, you keep up the good work. I enjoyed seeing you a little bit. I saw you at Derby Day and Cotillion Day, and you do a lot of good things for racing, and it's always nice to see you. Keep up the good work. Keep putting the good word out there about this fine sport we're in, because you got to love it. You love the animals, and you love the competition.
100%. Tony Black, everybody, the one and only. Love you, Tone.
Steve, take care.
Tony Black. Heading to the break, we will have the K's. Caitlin and Kevin. KK. And KF. Thanks to Bill Landis for the fun ripped from yesteryear. I do want to slip in. Don't have a lot of time here, but I did hear back from Courtney Reed. She says the race had really struggled in terms of quantity, and when it was downgraded by TOBA, by the Graded State Committee, they reassessed it as a part of the program, and that's why they distanced the distance race. Back after this, we'll look at the Churchill weekend. Stay with us.